Hello and welcome to yet another episode of Mastering Dungeons, a D&D podcast that talks about D&D stuff. Who would have thought? Here with me, as always, is my beloved co-host Teos Abadia. Hey Teos, what's
Hey,
going on,
Sean.
my friend?
I am in a very positive mood. I just got back from my reunion weekend. It was my 30th reunion and for college. And it was great. I saw my daughter who also attends, and yeah, like my heart is full. Like seeing good people, feeling good about my memories of campus, despite all the things I went through. Like it really felt good looking back on it. Feel good about the kids I met that are young students there, friends of my daughter's. And then I was super excited to see my son and come home. So yeah, overall
Nice.
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling like things are all right in the world momentarily. Don't jinx
Cool.
it.
How is everything at North Carolina Tech and Bar and Grill?
It's wonderful. Swimmingly, yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. The fries are still crisp.
Yeah, actually, I had to go to NC State because they beat us in basketball, so all the celebrations took place there. It was very sad, but
So that is sad. But hey, it's
what are
all
you
in
gonna
the academic triangle there, right? So we're all
Research Triangle
happy.
Park forever.
Yep. So I wanted to say thank you to the mighty Jared, who sent me a copy of The Black Ballad, yes, from Storytellers Forge and Four Horse Publishing. I did not get a chance to sit down and read it yet. It's been quite busy time and it just came, but the book is beautiful.
Incredible.
Just looking through it makes me want to read it, and I'm not a visually oriented person, so that is quite an accomplishment. So yeah, I mean, it is about death and exploring that, I believe, from what I've read of the back and the intros, and it's that evocative pull from that, from the layout and the art, just captures the imagination.
Yeah, really beautiful. I love it. Like that has like silver on the side. And I too, because I was away at this reunion, I got it right before I went off. And so I have not been able to look at it. But it really looks amazing. I mean, God, the cover. And just it's incredible to me, how fortunate are we in our hobby that we now, that someone can create this and they aren't, Wizards of the Coast or even Kobold Press, they can be a far smaller entity and have an incredible product like this. That's just unbelievable. And hats off to the creators, to the team. But also I celebrate the industry just being at that point where a book this beautiful can arrive. And so I'm excited to look at the Black Ballad and read through it because it looks really incredible.
For sure. And the Mighty Jerd is one of our sponsors, and
Thank
we
you.
also get emails from our patrons, or emails, tweets, Discord messages, YouTube comments. So we are going to answer one today. This one comes to us via YouTube from Michael J. Pastor, who was commenting on something that we talked about before about the m potential modular nature of fifth edition when it was being designed. And Michael says, is it possible that they, being Wizards of the Coast making fifth edition, actually succeeded in their goal of modularity, not directly but indirectly? There are so many, quote, plug and play systems or subsystems that have been created by third party publishers that one can bolt on, replace, or refine with the original infrastructure. What wasn't made originally has been made subsequently, and therefore has created a positive feedback loop, keeping it around for 10, now 10 plus years. And I think that is definitely a good way to look at it. I think that's a generous way to look at it in terms of giving Wizards of the Coast the credit that they did this purposefully, because I don't think that they did this purposefully. I think it's definitely true that what came out was a system that can be added to, can be replaced, but that's more the nature of role-playing games and role-playing game systems than it is of any intentionality of design. In order to design that intentionally, I think Wizards, the D&D team there that made fifth edition would have had to have been much larger, had much better funding, and had a lot more time. Then you could have gotten potentially gotten a system where it was intentionally made to be used in different ways by different people. Any role-playing game can be used in different ways by different people, but in for that design to be intentional, there needs to be great care. And so the way that it was talked about potentially to be designed was, you want to make it feel like, oh, D&D, we can do that. You want to make it feel like fourth edition with at will encounter daily powers. You can play
Tactical
it that way.
miniatures, right? Yeah.
Right. And that's not what this is. But it is a well-designed game, which does then lend itself to have people understand that design and plug in their own additions to that system.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see that there are a couple of things that are in this question that I both agree with but don't sort of see eye to eye. Modularity was really the idea, as you kind of said, Sean. It was really that idea that you could, in reading the book, say, I'm going to turn this on, or I'm going to turn that on, or I'm going to turn these two things on, but not these four. And that's not at all present in the book. And so that was sort of, if you will, a design failure, though that's a hard word to use. I wouldn't really use that word, but that design didn't come through. As they worked on it was too hard and they couldn't really put it together. And I agree with you that it would have taken more time and more people to try to get that to be there. And I think the great question is, do you even want that, right? I think you've asked this in the show notes, Sean, so it's not an original thought on my end, but I recall, I wish I could access the forums, which no longer exist, from back in the days, to look up the many times that I said, I don't know that this modularity is a good idea. Because you end up with a lot of people playing a game differently. And that destroys the cohesive nature, right? And if you imagine a group of people getting together to play Storm King's Thunder, but one person wants these, domain creation rules, and the other person wants this OD&D streamlined experience, and the other person expects a fourth edition tactical miniatures game, because that's how they've all been separately playing D&D. That's not necessarily a great thing. We have old editions that you can turn to if you really feel that strongly. But where I think this really was an enormous, fantastic success was that there was a clarity of vision from the beginning of the process to the end of the process, which was about speaking to all of the editions of D&D. And this was, for many of the leaders of this effort and team members, was something that they seemed to really feel evocatively. And modularity was one of the things that came off of that, was this desire to be able to turn things on and off. That didn't happen. But what did was this through line of saying, hey, we're appealing not just to our current players, but our old players, including players we've lost, and people who like those kinds of play. And it started with, running through all of these different editions of D&D and seeing what is it in these editions that appealed, right? Why was this so fun at the time and now? And so what you ended up with is not modularity, but speaking to those different editions, right? A first level character has many things that speak to second edition or even earlier, as Rob talked about in the video that we linked last week. That was the huge success, right? And I think that has been one of the keys to the enduring appeal of fifth edition for 10 plus years, is that clarity of vision around the design, which is very interesting to note because we are stepping away from some of those aspects now. And that may be genius because maybe that it's time for the design to shift and appeal differently and provide different experience, or maybe it's folly and we won't know for some time.
The one way in my mind that you could get modularity in the same game, if you want to, and it's again, maybe we don't want to, is to have a design where each tier of play is a slightly different game. So you could levels 1 to 5, 1 to 4, whatever. That's your basic D&D game. That is your, you have two things that your character can do, When you start and you only make one choice during character creation. Then when you hit fifth level or random level, then this part comes into play. Now you start playing a slightly different game. And when you hit 10th or 20th or however many levels you want, that way everyone can still be playing the same game. They're just playing it at different tiers of play, which brings out different kinds of play elements. Even then, you're talking about an effort to link all of those things and make one build up on another, which is a huge design task.
It's a huge design task, and it's a questionable one. And that, like when we saw with the D&D Bastions being something that started at, I forget, fifth level, seventh level, whatever it was, why are you telling me that nobody wants to run a tavern at level one? Right? And in fact, why are you supposing that the goal of it is that I get magic items and power and gold and things like that, rather than the actual story and play of it, right? You're making these in this modular, I can choose to turn on or off Bastion play. You're making these big guesses as what players want that I don't think are backed by, at least by what I see, but that could be my own bias too, right? It's never easy to be on the design teams. I'm not trying to be critical of the individuals, but all of these things are questionable, right? And so it's very hard when you come into modularity, it becomes really hard to think about what it does. The subsystems that we see from third-party publishers are often a lot of fun. They're often imperfect. No shocker there. But there's a reason why they're sort of being provided by a third party, because they're not the critical part of play, which is different than I think what the goal of modularity was. The goal of modularity was critical play elements can vary. Some of them were not, like things like, I think Mike Merle's long talked about, often blogged about, wanting to support mass combat, right? To really go back to even the wargaming roots of things. That clearly never made it in. It's never succeeded in any edition, so that's no personal failure. It's just something that didn't work out. But there were things that, the idea of feats being able to be optional, right, is something that even the team now is stepping away further. So it's fascinating. I love this topic.
So thank you, Michael, for that question. And now let's get into our news and commentary section, starting with the Fallout TV series. It has dropped. It is on Amazon Prime. And as that TV show becomes public, Modiphius has sold out of their books. According to an article from the Bill of Lost Souls, Modiphius has sold out of the print publications of their Fallout product. Physical versions of the core rulebook, the GM's toolkit, and the player bundle are all sold out. You can still get them on digital digital sites such as tabletops or DriveThruRPG, but they're going to have to do some more printing if they want to keep up with the demand from these books, which I thought was interesting, timely, and it's not often that we see this connection between a non-RPG medium actually affect RPG sales. Now, maybe there's no correlation. Maybe this is just a, it just so happens that they ran out when the show dropped, but correlation may sometimes mean causation. You
Well,
don't know.
and I think, yeah, I mean, hopefully this is correlated, right? I'm looking at the Modiphius website right now. They have, a lot of minis and dice and things like that that are available. There is one copy left of the Fallout role-playing game starter set. So clearly there are a number of things that are sold out, that, RPG plus GM screen is sold out and so on. So this seems to be all quite factual. Yeah, is it linked is fantastic. And what I'd want to know is how did they link it, right? Because one thing that was surprising to me, well, I think everybody's always been surprised by Star Wars, right? Like any number of Star Wars things come out on the media side, this does not correspond to the matching role-playing game book selling out, no matter whether it's fourth edition, D&D during the fourth edition era that controlled Star Wars saga, or with FFG creating products or any of that. it's never seemed to really correlate. Whether Star Wars is hot or cold doesn't matter for the RPG. Song of Ice and Fire, right? Game of Thrones comes out. Are the Green Running books falling off the, you know, coming off the shelves, you know, and everybody buying them up? No, not at all. In fact, it was really hard to have people even remember that RPG existed. So I don't, yeah, it's amazing. I'd be really curious to learn what's behind it, if it is indeed linked. Hopefully the answer is this is a new era of interconnectedness and people will actually seek out experiences related to some change like this. It would be great.
So speaking of crossover IPs, WBURFM published an interview with Hasbro CEO Chris Cox. And it was interesting to me because there were five questions that they asked Chris. And then the preview of the story had a little lead in talking about some general topics. And as it is with stuff that tries to boil everything down into one sentence, some of the information was true-ish, but not necessarily spot on. And then we get to the five questions, and I just laughed because it was the typical CEO speak of trying to say nothing while trying to say something and wanting to get a point across, but not being able to actually say the point you want because it might not sound exactly promising or humble or, you know, what have you. And so I wanted to play a little game. I wanted to read you, Teos, the question.
Uh-huh.
And have you answer it truthfully as, you know, as not the CEO of Hasbro, but just as somebody who is in touch with the industry, mm-hmm. and knows sort of what's going on.
Okay. So I'm going to do my best to say, here's what the answer didn't have to cover your butt.
Here's the answer, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Let's go. All right. I'm ready.
Teos, can you explain the mass layoffs of last year and why certain jobs were affected?
It's super hot right now for companies to lay people off. It results in a giant jump in stocks, which recovers a lot of your valuation, enables you to do all kinds of business things. And if I want to try to put a little bit of a spin on it, but this is not entirely non-factual. So first reason is, other companies do it. They were rewarded hugely financially for it. So we should do it too. There is no evidence. You know, if we go to the university level, there's no great evidence that firing people results in a leaner organization, a better organization. So that's not at all the reason. But getting those rewards from the financial system for doing these things does in fact prevent us from having to lay off more people when we don't know the answer to how to make the company better. And so many things are out of control. And so we may just be heading to worse years. And since we know how to do anything, this actually rescues us and prevents us from firing more people.
Awesome. In his answer, Chris Cox had mentioned something about the toy side versus the digital and game side. Yeah. So the follow-up question was, what is it that's more challenging about the toy side that has you pivoting more to the game and digital sides?
Toys aren't selling. You parents are terrible and allowing your kids to rot their brains out in front of screens. This means that they're not playing with action figures and dolls to dress up and things like that. And even when we try to add mild digital stuff, that's not good enough. So we're going to make more Monopoly Go type things for older people. And we're going to lay people off and try to do more digital stuff and slowly pivot, but we can't figure this out. There's no answer. Nobody knows whether somehow toys will make a giant comeback the way board games did. So who knows?
Great answer.
But digital stuff selling, there we go.
Okay. A number of fans said they were outraged when a leaked corporate document came out that would have taken some royalty money from individual creators who make content of their own for the game, say a new monster or a new world. Hasbro walked back the plan, but some fans are still unhappy with the direction the game is going. How do you make sure to win them back?
This is sort of a two-part question. If I really get back to your actual question, how do we win them back? We don't need to. We can just replace them with new people, if I'm being totally frank. So we can just appeal to people. Plus, most people don't care. I mean, most people still gas up with Exxon gas, and that place like literally destroyed people's livelihoods, coastlines, the ocean, ecosystems, and they're forgiven, and people still gas up for Exxon. So that's not really the problem. We can handle that. We have PR departments, we have marketing, we have new products, and we have fans who frankly just don't care. So that's not the problem. As to kind of the earlier part of it, the setup of it, look, we have so many departments and so many people, we never know what one or the other is doing. And so, one group's working on one project around an OGL revision, another one's worried about this aspect, which is a legitimate worry of whether RIP is threatened by the OGL and how to handle it. And then deadlines crash together and we show someone a version that we don't really totally think through and approve. People get outraged and then we have to react to it. But I think we fixed that. We put everything in the Creative Commons, because that kind of solves the problem. And this wasn't that big a deal. We're just a scrambled organization like all other corporations out there. Our bad.
Excellent answer. Magic the Gathering was Hasbro's first billion-dollar brand, and the company is seeking to steer it toward more casual players by printing and putting out more cards for people to play. But Bank of America briefly downgraded the company's stock in response, saying that Hasbro was, quote, killing the golden goose by flooding the market. Is that a potential trade-off here?
Yeah, it's totally a potential trade-off. You have to look at whether how you're making the money, right? And as people steer towards digital, then we want to steer people towards Arena and the number of digital customers we have and how they respond to digital releases. Frankly, we can't believe that these cards are still selling the way they are. So we just keep pinching ourselves and keep making it. And trying to make as many as we can to get as much money of it as possible because this playing card thing keeps playing out. And so, every now and then we're going to kind of screw up and do too many, but that's okay. The collector market doesn't make us a lot of money, it makes other people money. And we like that because it's an ecosystem, but it's not our top priority. We'll never say that publicly, but that's the reality. So, flooding the market's okay as if it works for us and doesn't destroy it long term. We never know if it is or isn't. So, we just play and it ebbs back and forth. And every now and then, we won't have wine and dine Bank of America people sufficiently to prevent them from saying things.
Good answer there. Finally, Hasbro has a long or has a video game coming out starring Matthew McConaughey after the Dungeons and Dragons movie did only okay. But is this where you're headed? Not so much Hollywood movies, but blockbuster games.
Yeah, of course, except when we aren't. So we will do a lot of different types of video game type things. Whenever one of them works, we'll tell all investors that this is our strategy. Whenever that doesn't work, we will pivot to one of the other things and say that that's the strategy and try to look as smart as we can as possible. Because, I mean, we just finished telling you that we were shuttering a whole bunch of studios, and then Baldur's Gate 3 was surprisingly, amazingly good. Good on us. We hope for more of
That is the interview that I wanted to read. That is the interview that we deserve. That is the interview that we're never going to
gonna
have.
go bathe. It still feels horrible to
Yeah.
say things like that. I
Hey,
mean, it's just,
man, it's
but
the
this is,
truth, right?
we are all culprits in this, right? Like, we are part of the fabric of this society that does this. So all I can say is, like, man, support public education. Get money to teachers, try to slowly change the world because this is a horrible setup and you've just stripped me of all the positivity from reunion weekend. But challenge. I mean, just this is the world we live in where Monopoly Go that isn't even really like a Monopoly game is billions of dollars based on millions of billions in marketing. I don't even track the numbers. It's all bizarre, right? And the movie increasingly looks like it probably was a success that became a tax write-off, right? And so nothing makes sense anymore. Nothing is truly real. And at the end of it are the things that we as individuals are all doing, but also the regulations that we use to for companies. And so support regulations. I guess that's the raise your kids right, support regulations. There we go.
There you go. But we have better news that D&D Beyond is preparing for Vecna. The adventure Vecna Eve of Ruin will release on May 21st or earlier, I believe, if you have ordered it online in the digital bundle. D&D Beyond is now providing insights into the product. An article called Who is Vecna and Why Must He Die provides the villain's history from the OD&D scant words that it brought from the Greyhawk setting to his links to other lore, such as the Book of Vile Darkness, the artifact he creates, his becoming a lich, betrayal by Kaz, links to Ravenloft, and so much more. For those of you who don't know, Vecna is an anagram of Vance, of which the author, J.D. Vance, his magic system was imported into D&D. So it's a Vancian magic system.
And the novels were fundamental to sort of things that Greyhawk or that Gary Gygax liked. And so, yeah, made a lot of sense.
So what else was in this article?
So the thing that, you know, I don't know if I missed this somewhere, but they kind of just talk about how, you know, Vecna was trying to become a god and he failed and because Cass stabbed him and then he failed again. And now Vecna is a greater deity. And while I did see that in the DMG, he's listed in the deity thing, I just assumed that that was a lack of like demigod versus god type filtering. But I guess he's just a greater deity now. And I don't recall that happening in an adventure, but maybe I'm failing my lore. I'm going to have to go to the FR wiki and look up his whole history. But so he is now a god, which makes it always strange if this is now a campaign against a god somehow. Will we be allowed to defeat Vecna and fight him? Like, how do you know? Level 20 PCs in this edition of the game don't really fight gods. Versus, you know, the top tier 4E could. So it'll be interesting to see, and same of 2E and things like that. So we'll see. There's also a second article, Sean, playing a lich in D&D. I thought that was kind of cool. It reminded me of there's a really neat old classic Dragon Magazine article on becoming a lich. And this is kind of like that. It's pretty nicely written. And it talks through, you know, if your DM approved it, how could a high level PC, right, a PC that has ninth level spells, become a lich as part of play? And so we're given, and it tries to do that in really few words, which is not easy. So it talks about how you could do this by maybe appealing to somebody like Orcus or Tenebris. You could gain the Book of Vile Darkness and unlock a secret there. You could seek out a patron or use the wish spell. And then we get information on the ritual to become a lich, which is 13 days to construct what is now called a spirit jar and brew a potion of transformation. So that seems to be a 2024 change on removing phylactery, which is fine. If you fail at this ritual, you become a bone claw. And then kind of some thought process around your capabilities, what it means to be undead, how to draw inspiration from the lich stat block. There's a section on can you play as a good lich that provides things for the DM to mull over, and I guess the player as well. And there are also questions on how to protect your spirit jar. You have to kind of feed souls in it to maintain it, which is seems to be sort of taking that Tomb of Annihilation concept and leaning into that. Kind of cool. I overall enjoy this as a read, and it tickles my brain memories around the similar concepts that have been out there in the past where people have wrestled with whether a player should become a lich.
For those of you who play in Grimhollow, in Ghostfire Gaming's world, you will recognize that there is a lich transformation and that a lot of this is similar to that. But, you know, that's okay. It's a trope that is fairly well used, fairly well known. And so you're going to get some parallel construction with those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And there was one other thing, a prequel adventure. Is that true?
Indeed.
Vecna, Nest of the Eldritch Eye. I have not looked at this, but I am hearing it's out there.
I took a look today. It just came out, you know, right around the time of us recording. So I went through it, raced through it, which was not hard because it is not long. So you know, if you think of things like when Ravenloft came out, right, we had the what's it called, Death House? Is that the name? You know, given out that was like a sample that you could be like, cool, play through this, and you're going to want to now be in Ravenloft. And think about all that energy it created to have that, right? And this was available for store play. Stores were running it. They received a copy through the WPN program and all this. Well, here, this is a adventure that is only given out on D&D Beyond to those pre-ordering the adventure through D&D Beyond only. So go to your local gaming store. You can't get this. There isn't a writer listed. Lead designer is Chris Perkins, designer Mackenzie Darmus. So maybe Mackenzie wrote this based on Chris' notes or something. Hard to read the tea leaves exactly. It is for level 3, 4 to 6 PCs. And the level 3 is interesting because the adventure begins at level 10. So this isn't a setup. And so often the D&D previews or prequels don't actually lead into the larger thing, right? It doesn't match up. And I'm always shocked by that. But this is 2 to 3 hours playtime. And I guess what it does is prepare your players more than your characters, unless you're going to run a larger campaign in between the two. And we're taken to Neverwinter. And Lord DeGault Neverember, who was apparently recovered from the events of the D&D movie, hires the PCs to patrol the city. And they find a guy, you know, holding an eye, and a chain of events related to Vecna leads you into the catacombs below the city's famed graveyard, which is called Neverdeath. And there you find Cultus of Vecna. It's short, it's linear. The adventure suitably establishes concepts of Cult of Vecna. If you've played things like Age of Worms and dealt with the Vecna cultists there, you know, this feels a lot like that kind of experience. And I think, you know, somebody who'd looked at it this morning on our Discord channel said, you know, should this really have been, is this best, is this serving D&D best as being a pre-order benefit? And I agree with them that it's not. It's fine, you know, but if you're going to run the adventure, this isn't a great lead into that. This doesn't make your run of the adventure better, as far as I can tell. And this could have been energy and excitement for all of the hobby to be playing off of this, especially if it was in PDF format, so that people could run it in stores. You could have game days around this. You know, there could, like, that to me is great marketing that leads to sales and community and excitement and the idea of an adventure feeling like a big major thing, right? This is the time of Vecna 2024, right? Like, let's go. It doesn't feel like that, right? It feels like just a weak marketing attempt to shift you to buy things on their digital platform. And I don't love it.
Thank you for that. We also get news that a new OP program is coming from Gamehole Publishing. So according to a post in their Facebook group, Alex Kammer has said that Wardens of the Eastern Marches will premiere in 2025. We didn't get any strong details on specifics, but Alex did say that player characters must be members of one of 6 possible alliances, and alliances in this campaign will play a central role, not just in the adventures, but in the actual play experience of the campaign. Those 6 groups are the Order of the Intrepid, an organized crime outfit, the Enterprise Guild, a commerce and trade group, the Quill Society, a knowledge and academic arcane group, Order of the Pontificate, a philosophical spiritual divine group, the Golden Conservancy, a nature-focused group, and the Sovereign Military Order of Asura, which is made up of active and retired soldiers. Alex said there will be much, much, much more to come on these alliances, the program itself, and their ongoing further publishing efforts. But this only came out less than a week ago, so we haven't heard anything since then. But as organized play veterans and people who are definitely organized play knowledgeable and curious, I wanted to throw that out there to our audience and see if you had any comments on that.
Oh gosh, so many thoughts. I mean, so one is, Alex has I'm sure, a great vision around this because he has so much experience in it. It's a very interesting event for our industry, for our D&D area of the industry, that somebody who's been an official partner for Wizards would want to launch their own program like this that is not tied to the auspices of Wizards. That is telling, a little frightening, that Adventurers League has reached some point to where, I think Baldwin Games, I wouldn't be shocked if Baldwin Games would do the same thing if they weren't so close to Wizards as they are and weren't being allowed to create sort of alternative adventures to keep convention play interesting and so on. They can create their own little campaigns, and so it's easier for them, whereas I think it's harder for Alex's group in Gamehole. And that's a shame because, yes, you do want alternate experiences, like we've had the Eberron campaign, we've had, Ravenloft campaign, things like that. But you also want the general campaign to continue to have real strong energy and to reach out in various ways to the community. If it's not working except in very narrow ways, it's not working. So I don't know. This does it causes me to ponder and reflect, which I'm doing a lot of. I don't have any answers here. I really just have questions and pondering. Because this campaign, at least the description of it, sounds really interesting, really cool, but it sounds big and engrossing. It sounds like a main campaign rather than an offshoot campaign to me when it has factions like this. But it'd be interesting to see. It's too early to tell, but if it's really meant to be a big sort of major thing, then that is harder for the community to kind of walk, have a foot in both and all of that. And yeah, a lot to think through.
Well, we've seen D&D Converse in the wild, but now we are also seeing D&D clothing from Black Milk Clothiers. They are partnering with Wizards of the Coast for D&D themed a clothing line, from a Red Dragon knit sweater to a Strahd robe to the D&D graffiti biker shorts. There is so much in this line that might catch your eye and catch your fancy. Black Milk is an Australian urban clothing designer and manufacturer, and we have a link in the show notes to all of the different outfits and accessories that you can get. Some of them are obviously very D&D focused in terms of the big logos or iconic monsters like the Mimic. And some of it is the print is so fine, or the patterns. Unless you look very closely, you don't even notice that it is like a die or some sort of D&D logo within the pattern.
Yeah, I had not looked at this until I saw it in the show notes, and I'm looking at it again now, and it's really amazing. Like, there's a beholder dress, or sorry, a displacer beast dress that it just looks like a really neat pattern until you notice that the swirls are its tentacles, and then the body of the creature is at the very bottom. I mean, my daughter would wear a lot of these clothes. It's actually the first time I've seen, like, everything is really super cool for women. It's hard to find that. There have been a couple of examples over the years, I guess, but there are some really neat outfits for women that, yeah, it can look super geeky or not, depending on the choices you make. It's really cool. I invite everybody to take a look at this. That's neat.
Yeah, I noticed that there was some subtlety to some of the pieces, and so it caught my eye. I thought it would be of interest to folks out there who may want to buy something and show their geekery without it being so out and in front of them with their clothing. So
Great stuff. And
check that out.
speaking of clothing, I did go for the Converse shoes, which were not as expensive as I feared they would be. And you can customize them, which is really cool. And while there is sadly no flump, you can choose, like, what goes on the back, on the front, what the tongue is, the color, the design. There are a lot of really neat things. So if you saw the Converse shoes and just saw them as sort of like one of the couple of stock pictures, you may want to take a closer look at that as well, because it really is not a terrible price for, shoes these days that can be a 100 or more. These are fairly affordable as shoes go. and you can highly customize it to look like what you want. So I ordered a pair.
Nice. Last but not least, our creator corner. I wanted to highlight Monsters of Drakenheim, that Kickstarter that we mentioned, where support for D&D Beyond is right there in the Kickstarter. So you can choose D&D Beyond as your virtual tabletop and have access to the Monsters of Drakenheim, all its content, right in D&D Beyond from the start. It will include over 150 new monsters, and I know they've already shattered that with their stretch goals. You can harvest felled foes to craft loot, engage in epic boss fights, explore forbidden lairs. All of that is supported by the Kickstarter. This is from Ghostfire Gaming, partnering with the Dungeon Dudes. I, a few months ago, went up and play tested some of the monsters with Monty and Kelly up at their offices in Toronto, and it was a lot of fun. There is new things that monsters can do with them, new conditions monsters might put on your character. So if you're looking for something, you can play it straight, or you can play with these additional rules. It's good stuff. The Kickstarter is got a week left as of when this show drops, and it's almost at a million. It's wow. 820,000 right now. So there's a good chance that it might reach $1 million. So congratulations to Ghostfire and the Dungeon Dudes for that.
Yeah, Dungeon Dudes, fantastic people. Really enjoyed meeting them at Game Hole, and I'm glad for them to have that success.
Mm-hmm. So our main topic this week here on Mastering Dungeons is going to continue along the same lines as we've been going the last few weeks. We're going to talk today about keeping your new campaign healthy and strong. So we've talked about world building. We've talked about creating starting locations, starting adventures for your new campaign. Then we talked about creating or leveraging player-facing rules that will intrigue them and ground them in your new world and your new campaign. I wanted to keep on the same path, but change tack just a little bit to talk about how to keep a campaign going once you get it started. I will never forget when Wizards of the Coast released this information a while back about how many sessions an average campaign lasted. And it was between 3 and 5,
yeah.
Which shows that so many campaigns get off to a good start. They get a little momentum for those first 3 or 4 sessions, and then something happens and they crash. If you have been playing for years, you may have experienced this. I know that I have, both as a player and as a game master, when it just all falls apart for so many reasons.
Yeah.
But there are steps you can take to try to fend off some of the things that might happen that will derail a campaign. So let's talk now about how you can maintain a healthier long-term campaign. I just made up a list, like one top 10, but we may add some as we go.
Yeah.
And we may decide that some of them don't even matter, because Teos and I are going to bring our own thoughts to this process. So the first thing I want to talk about is choosing the right players for your campaign. You may be in a position where you only have 4 players or 5 players, and that's it. You can't really choose who's going to play because these are your buddies, or this is your lunch group at work, and that's just how it is. So you might not be able to choose. But if you do have a choice of players for a campaign, it's important to ask the question, who is really willing to commit to this? It's a commitment, right? Yeah. It is a thing.
Yeah,
so you both, want to
both
want
physically,
to
right, showing up, and right. that they're going to be part of the coolness of the campaign, that the campaign will be great because they're in it, right? They're not going to be there on their phones distracted or derailing it, or, you know, hurting the rest of the party, or you know, they're not going to find their fun. And so they're going to commit to the play of it, right?
So you could ask yourself, if you have more than just a group, just a 4 or 5 player group, what in this campaign will be of specific interest to these particular players? What interests them? And will those interests be served over the length of this campaign? Is there going to be a shift somehow, either in what you're running or their interests? And how can you keep the campaign in front of their interests? Also, how do the players mesh with each other? Do you have different player types who, during certain campaigns, may get along very well together, but during a different campaign, there might be conflict between them, not necessarily in terms of anger or drama, but just in terms of their interest.
Taking a step back to that whole player, starting with thinking of your players that you have is really valuable. And in general, in almost all situations, there are players out there who could join you. Unless, like you're saying, it's our lunch group, or the whole point is because these are my friends and I want to spend time with them. That is totally valid, right? Then, well, it's not, I'm not going to bring someone else in. I'm going to create a campaign for them. Because this is my group and I want to be with this group, or I'm physically locked in at lunch at my company, and these are the people. But otherwise, I would say it's amazing how different players can change your play. And so it's worth thinking, if you have that flexibility, don't be afraid to try new players from time to time. And one of the things you can do is run a short experience of something else that is more in tune with what you'd like to be running. See how those players go and then adjust, right? And their time, and it's hard to say no to players, but so it's easier when it's a short thing. You run the short thing, you see how it goes, you see whether the new players work, whether the old players are working, and then you can launch the real thing. But I've had very it has been good for me, because like I want to get together with my friends, but I also really want to be running certain types of campaigns. And so tweaking over time who is in my campaigns and adjusting who I bring in, right, out of the possible players, who is part of that group, makes it all more fun for all of us.
For sure. Then the second step is, once you have chosen the right players that are going to fit this campaign, double check and make sure that it is the right campaign for these players. If you think that this high espionage, very role play heavy investigation and intricate plots that have to be unraveled, if you think that's perfect, but then you realize later that one of your players, oh yeah, the last time we tried to do something like that, they were fine for the first adventure. But as soon as we tried to do it the next adventure, they were asking for more combat. Then you might have to do some tweaking to keep that player involved by changing up the beats of the campaign to space out that intricate role playing or very cerebral figuring things out with constant battles or one battle after another for at least a portion of the session.
Yeah, absolutely. Things like whether the players are optimizers, or the degree of optimization they enjoy, the de degree of role playing. Like maybe you have players who, boy, they want to turn everything into a theatrical performance, and you want to focus on tactics as a GM, right? We often say opposite, but that's a perfectly fine way for you to want to run a game. So then you may want to choose the players accordingly, or modify the campaign accordingly, right? If you've got people who really want theatrical stuff and you really want to play with these folks, then having something that's just dungeon destruction is probably not going to work for that group as well, and you want to pick the adventure accordingly.
Then we talk about session zeros a lot. We've had full shows on session zeros. So I just wanted to mention session zero again by saying, You should undertake an honest and right-sized session zero. Session zeros are important for a lot of reasons. So you want to take the time to discuss key points. You want to take the time to discuss preferences and triggers and all of those things. If you are already very familiar with the players, though, you can sort of shortcut some of these things and get to the key points that are important for this particular campaign. So you don't want to suck all the oxygen out of the campaign in your session zero. If creating characters and discussing it is going to take 5 hours, so you divide up your session zero into 2, 2.5 hour sessions, you're already on to session three by the time the campaign starts. And it there may the excitement for it may have been lost. So make sure your session zero is complete, but also make sure it's right sized. Do just enough to get all the important things out. This is what the campaign's going to be. This is how long it's going to be. This is the characters we're going to be playing. Let the rest of it happen either off nights or just get into the game.
Yeah, and for session zeros, I like to do a fair bit of that sort of establishing of what the campaign should be like, both as a kind of check on my end to make sure that we're gonna that we do have what I think we have player wise, interest wise, but also to communicate where we're headed, right? So the expectation is really clear. And so and but I don't want to have, like you talked about, that lack of energy. So I often do a survey beforehand, just using, Google Forms or SurveyMonkey or anything like that. Just send out a survey with some questions, and you don't want a million questions, but you may want to ask things that you think you already know the answer to, like, how challenging do you want this to be, or how much do you want everybody to be optimizing, or things like that, right? Like, how important is the character builds to you? Just various types of questions. It could also be campaign questions, like, are you interested? Which of the things interest you the most? Pirates, undead, traps, tomb exploration, whatever. Like, those are some things I did for Tomb of Annihilation. And it can be really helpful to just go, like, a fair number of people really like pirates. Okay, I'm going to expand that part of the adventure, right? Or if nobody likes intrigue, role playing with an ability, then, well, I guess downplaying that makes sense. And some of the results, can shock you, like, and you can find that there might be big divergence. So you might be, this is the group I'm going to run, but I have to acknowledge that some of them like a very challenging game and some of them do not. And so I'm going to have to speak to both as I run. Those kinds of things are really useful. And then by having that survey, then now you've actually made it easier for everybody to create characters at the session zero if you want to do character creation at your session zero, because we've got those sort of establishing factors. So, like, I just ran, we had a Blade Runner combination character generation and start the second adventure. We'd played the first one, which was great because that was almost like a prequel, but one of the players said, I really want to create new characters for this. And everybody was like, yeah, okay, sure. And so we showed up and made the characters, but we had that pre-established first adventure down, which made it much easier to think through what kind of roles and choices everybody wanted to do. And there's clear expectations about the type of play, so that made it a lot easier, right? Served as a session, a pre-session zero in a way.
Yeah, I played Daggerheart last week, and I'm going to play again this week. And we did character creation in an hour, thanks to Demiplane's wonderful implementation of that. And so character creation went pretty quickly, and we really even discussed rules a bit as we were creating the characters. And then we got to play for 2 hours. The game master is really good. The players are really good and used to games other than D&D. So all of that was sort of known, and we knew that about each other, which made it go really smoothly. And we didn't have to spend too much extra time talking about the characters or talking about the rules. We knew enough to know when we could just start. And it was very handy.
Yeah, and one other thing, when you're doing this kind of character generation and it kind of establishing the whole point of this, really going back, is we're doing this to create a great a better campaign, and so it doesn't fall apart, because campaigns fall apart so for so many reasons, including lack of energy, miscommunications, different play styles, and all of that. So the more that we're setting things up on the common ground, the better off we're going to be. And you can, as you get more experience with this kind of session zero and campaign running campaigns, you can think through what you like to be part of that setup, right? Like, do you like to have links between all the characters? Do you want to introduce them to each other through play? Do you want to have them tied into organizations in the game? You know, you can think through all those things that might strengthen the relationship, but also complicate it. And based on your ability to navigate that, your previous experiences, your players' experiences, you could think through how carefully you want to do that. So, for example, for Blade Runner, I, both out of my time, and one thing that's nice about Blade Runner is I know that I'm not running this campaign for eons. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to invest in it super fully, right? I don't have to do the work I would do if I'm going to run this for years. So I can say, you know what, let's just, character generation is going to be character generation, and I will do steps later to add to it. So when they came up with things like key memories, I might have provided some minor nudges based on what I know the campaign's about, but largely let them just do it, right? But now I will go back and I will reinforce some things to add that layer that I want out of a campaign where the campaign is more based on the characters, right? So I'm going to do that afterwards. But in a lot of ways, if this were a larger campaign, I would do it beforehand to set things up and say, here are themes, here are, because I want you to be part of that fabric of where we're going to go in the campaign.
Yeah. So at the session zero, I strongly suggest the next step, which is find a schedule that will work for everyone. Often we will say, hey, is everybody free Saturday night at 6? We're going to play. We'll do our session zero. And then everyone makes it to that session. And then you say, okay, when do we play next? And everyone's like, well, we'll figure it out. You know, we'll get to, you know, and you leave. And that's the last time you're all able to meet. That's happened to me more than once. So at that session zero, try if you can to find a schedule that works. If you can get everyone, it may take you a half an hour.
Yeah.
But if everyone will sit down and look at their schedule and say, oh, nope, I can't do it that night. If you can say, how about we play, even if it's just the next session, can everyone play next Wednesday because it's a holiday at 1 p.m. because no one's working? Does that work? Right. Get that session locked in. And if you can, make up a regular schedule every 2 weeks, Saturday nights at 7. If you can at least get a verbal commitment, that takes a lot of onus off you then having to try to do it remotely, get everyone on the same page when you might not be able to get someone's attention for 3 days because they're not answering their email. While they're there, take care of that.
Yeah. And that whole, you know, you put a word in the show notes here, be flexible, regular, but flexible. I really love that because sometimes you do have to change away from what you'd like. While at the same point, somebody must make decisions and push for something, right? So a lot of times when I ask groups, like, what day can we play? Oh, boy, you get all these answers and all these. So what I often will do is I'll say, hey, I'm available, you know, Wednesdays, Fridays, whatever's, right? Here are 3 days. How does that work for everybody? And polls can help with this, too. So this is also something you can yep. precede by having this in a poll. And so, you know, you'll see, okay, here's what works for folks. And often it doesn't work, right? This is one of the maddening things, though, the older that people are, which is one of the reasons I often invite a larger pool initially to be possibly in the campaign. And so, you know, if what I find is, well, we have, you know, 4 players out of 6, well, you know, we'll do that, right? We'll run with the 4. But now it means we really have to make that work with the 4 that we have who can play regularly. And I may say, hey, you know, someone else, if you are able to make a session, I'll find a role for you, or I may not, depending on the type of campaign I'm doing. But what I will often do, you know, I like a weekly campaign because it becomes part of my schedule of what I do. I prepare on this day, I run on this day, and I like that cadence. The every other week is a little hard on me, but in this case, for the Blade Runner campaign, we had folks who said, you know, someone said every other week would actually work better. And then someone immediately chimed in and said, yeah, me too. And I said, you know, this is great. That's fine. Well, let's do this.
And the flexible part goes into this next thing, which is set an end date. And you may immediately say, but I don't want to set an end date for this campaign. I want it to be an ongoing campaign. That's okay. Set the end date because you're much more likely to get buy-in and you're much more likely to keep people's interests if there is a finish line. People will come back when they say, oh, there's only three more sessions. Oh, there's only two more sessions. Even if they love what's going on, they'll come. But even if they're like, oh, this is getting a little bit much for me, that end date will spur some people on just a bit more to get them there. And then you can always go further, which we will talk about later in this list.
Yeah, the end date, I've been surprised how effective that has been in my campaigns. Like I ran a Numenera campaign based on the Wandless series of novels by Tony DiTerlizzi. And I just had this idea and I wanted kind of to get to know the cipher system. And so I just said, hey, you know, this is gonna be four sessions. But I want to do that. And I was taking three novels and concluding them in four sessions, which I wasn't even sure I could pull off. But I was like, in a worst case, I'll run a fifth session. But I managed to do it, you know, by keeping the action going, keeping us focused, and weaving through the most important of what happens in those novels. And we had a really great time, and we all got to learn the system a bit and get a feel for it. And that was really high engagement, high interest. And in some ways, that can be better. The only caveat to that is if you do only short experiences, you may at some point lose people who don't get the investment out of it. So you may want to alter that, right? A little longer campaign, a shorter campaign. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But having that vision, right? Even like if you're running like something like this Vecna mega adventure we're talking about in the first part of the show, you know, you could still say, my thought is this is gonna run through whatever, you know, November. And now everybody knows, right? You know, and then maybe partway through you go, so folks, this is feeling a little more like, right? I ran Tomb of Annihilation and it was going forever. And then players wanted to be like, will we get to be higher than 10th level? Can we keep doing this? And I said, no. I'm ending this. I am at peak energy. I'm loving this. This is super fun. And then my energy is going to drop for this campaign. So we're just going to stop it, you know, like at the sweet spot because it'll get worse.
When you do start the campaign strong, and we've already covered this, but I wanted to add it again. So go back and listen to like creating the first adventure, because it's important to capture that energy and maintain that energy through the first encounter, through the first adventure, through the first session, and build on that energy rather than depleting that energy.
Yeah, absolutely.
My seventh one is find a way to engage between sessions, in parentheses, without overwhelming the players. So if you say we're going to play every other week, and people agree and they say every Saturday night, great, here we go. Then you go off and then things start to pile up. Even if it's every week, things start to pile up. Oh, the kids have, their recital. Oh, meeting with a business. Oh, family coming to visit. And it becomes much easier to lose focus. Because you're not at the table. So find a way to engage. Teos talked about sending out a poll. That could be it. It could be, hey, how did you like these things from last session? Yes, no. What do you want to do in the next session? Answer here. If you have a player who is a writer, say, hey, could you write up a 200-word summary of what your character saw? Hey, artist, could you draw me a picture of this NPC that you met? Hey, computer science person, could you build me this thing that will help me keep track of your reputation of your party. These are the
Oh,
variables
smart.
I need. If you can do that and keep them interested outside of the game in whatever way,
Yeah.
they will be more likely to come back to the table to play the game.
Yeah, it's a good point. Like when I was running Tomb of Annihilation, one player, and I didn't prompt this, but I should have prompted these kinds of things. But one player made a version of the map of Chult that you could scratch off, right? So they had found somewhere they read about a paint that you can use to cover paper and essentially turn it into a scratch off thing. So we could do hex exploration by scratching and revealing what was there, which was really cool. And another made puzzle cubes that they had made for a run of their epic that we wrote or the open. And they had those. So they were like, hey, you can use these however you want. So at times I would think of how to use those puzzle cubes because I had these physical props. And it is really true that it gets players excited. And I like to do a couple things around this angle of keeping players invested over time. And I come back to why, right? The why of it is the staying engaged so that we keep having a successful, fun campaign and that we are all aware of what we want it to be, right? Being on the same page around it, engagement and common understanding, communication. And so to do that, it's a combination of making sure everybody has the right information and that it continues to be interesting and playing off of their what they want out of it, right? So things like I try to really understand what each character is about and what the player wants for that character. It does not a and it, I don't mean plus two magic item, and I don't mean become king of the realm necessarily, though some of that a little more. But that idea of I'm looking at a broader level, I am a leader seeking to lead people. They may want to be king and they may want a plus two sword, but it's that they are looking for those kinds of leadership opportunities. And when you generalize like that, then you get a lot of opportunities to surprise and please and enable things, right? And give them choices that are hard choices. Do you if you do this, you lead the group, but if you don't, you've stuck to your guns and maybe gone with the moral choice. What do you decide? And that's fun either way. And areas of the character that they want to explore, questions they have, mysteries they particularly want to resolve in the campaign can push them towards that level of expertise and engagement, right? If you really care about the history of that cult of Vecna or whatever, then help that player become the person who's always unraveling these mysteries and the person who's, maybe creates a library or partners with one or becomes the head of the library and, all that kind of stuff. That kind of interplay. And that is the best. And you don't, a lot, I think a lot of times as DMs, we think we have to be an expert at it, but we don't. Just get your feet wet a little, play around with it and adjust as you go.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And it sort of leads into eight for me, which is leave room for changes without breaking the session zero contract. So as Teo said, based on what your players do, you may need to change, or you may need to change to make yourself happy and take the campaign in the direction you like. But always go back to that session zero contract that you made and make sure that you are fulfilling what you promised and what the players wanted. So I think that's pretty self-explanatory. And that go actually goes to nine too, which is have frequent check-ins. Check in with individual players and check in with the group as a whole. Some people may feel more comfortable saying something that possibly negative or constructive feedback individually. They don't want to do it in front of everyone. And some people are more likely to do it if they have the backing of the players that are there to say, I think we feel this. And they don't want to tell you in person, so do it both ways, to see if you're hitting all the marks, making everyone happy. Because if everyone's happy, then everyone's going to keep coming back Saturday night to keep playing your game.
Yeah, and that check-in is good. You can look at your if you did a poll up front, whether it was in person or digitally, you can look back at those questions you asked and say, well, I want to go check in and say, check in with everybody. Hey, do you want more of these themes or did we kind of cross them off the list, right? Do you want more pirates? Do you want more tombs of traps? Do you want more, whatever? is the challenge level okay for you, right? Because some of those people who said, I want low challenge may now be actually, I'd like a little more. Or they might say, no, it's great. Or they might say, this is still too hard. And I feel like my character is always in peril. So you get to reevaluate those things. And also it means the players know that you're listening. You can't, they will hopefully understand you can't please everybody exactly to the where they would set their dial, but you can please them enough that, and that they know that you're trying, right? You're trying to make it work for everybody, and that's all anybody can hope for.
Number 10, I had written end the campaign at the designated time with a climactic scene or a climactic adventure. And I want to even add to that, which is end the campaign at the designated time or when you know it's time. So it could be before the designated time that, all right, you know what? This has played out. There is more we could do, but I think this is a good stopping point. Or if you did say this is going to be a 10 session game campaign, we're at session 10. So here's the big scene against the boss, and you've been tracking the boss's cohorts and minions and plots, and there, you just succeeded at the top of a volcano. Hey, great. But you can, if you want to continue this, you can leave a path forward. You can say, you've defeated this enemy. There was a note on the enemy that speaks to a larger conspiracy. We can end here if anyone or everyone wants to, or we can continue for another 10 session arc that follows this that will take us from level, 10 to 15. What do people think? And then you're back to the session zero, right? You're discussing how you want to continue, if you want to continue. So that's my 10.
So 10 is really interesting, right? The idea of the campaign end, I think we could probably have it may be worth our having a show on that as a topic in this series, because I think the campaign end has a number of things. First, there's the lead up to the campaign end, where when you can see that end coming, either because you preordained it's going to be successions, or November is coming, or whatever, however it is that you communicated that end, and you're starting to get there. That is a time where you start pruning the paths and the story arcs and the options. The mysteries have to start getting solved, or right? You can't have all those red herrings out there anymore. And so you want to start kind of trimming that stuff, and you look at the player goals and to get accomplished, or how do we do that, right? And if it goes unfulfilled, can we point towards that having been something that happens post campaign or something, right? And that takes some time. That is a lot of DM craft work to in those sessions when you see X sessions remaining and I need to accomplish those things, right? But that's an important part to go through that and check those boxes and think through what your plan is, how you're going to get there. Then the actual ending itself, I generally love just a big, exciting fight, right? And it was funny to look back recently. I was thinking on D&D 5e campaigns and how many of them I think struggle and not without cause for the balance between the big boss fight and then what happens after that, if anything, and how to handle that. I mean, Rime of the Frost Maiden's hilarious. You kind of have the big boss fight in the middle and the threat, and then there's all this other stuff. Tomb of Annihilation has the you fight the end boss, but then there's a couple more rooms, and they kind of explain some stuff, but it's not really important, and nobody cares that they're exhausted by this fight. But like, what am I going to have a session for two more rooms? Otherwise, I have to tack it on the end of this big climactic, we're all just exhausted, kind of thing. It's really weird design, right? And so I think that's it. I don't. Do you want to talk about boss fights or end fights or things like that? You have any thoughts about that?
I would rather wait and
Okay. Okay.
let's do a
Yeah.
wrapping up your
That sounds
campaign
good. That sounds good.
show
Yeah.
because I think
Yeah.
we're
I think we've got a lot there we could use. So.
yeah, for sure. So anything else you want to add to this list before we move on?
I mean, I think one other thing is, how do you record what happened? And there's some really nice write-ups in the old Chris Perkins DM series that you can find a PDF out there that gathers all of it. I think there's your session notes. What do you want to record for each session? Or is a player recording it? Sometimes a player can do that. How do you do recaps at sessions so that players can recall what happened? And do you have the players do that? Do you announce, previously on? Do you mail out? Like, I like a one-page Word document. I bold all the NPC and place names, so all the kind of proper nouns get bolded. If there's something super critical, I might underline it or italicize it, but generally not. And I just try to quickly on one page force myself to one page, and I'm a long-winded person, as everybody knows. So that's a feat. One page, here's what happened, and send that out. And when I'm doing long campaigns, that becomes my Bible, and I put it in a binder physically so that I can look at it and keep those things going. And I work off of those because that's our common understanding between players and myself of what happened, right? And I like to find some mechanism for that, for carrying those things forward, and whether you share them at the beginning of sessions or not. I'm not so big on the previously on kind of thing, but many people are and believe in it, and so that's great to just find your method there.
No, that's a great thing that you could slide in under seven. Find your way to engage between sessions is lead a discussion about what happened in character, out of character, via Slack or Discord or whatever you use to communicate. Cool. All right. Well, with that, we are going to say goodbye to this episode, and we're going to say thank you to all of our listeners. We're going to give an extra special thank you to those patrons who support us, whether they are a Master of Dungeon supporter, a Master of the Realm supporter who get a shout out in our show notes, or a Master of the Multiverse. Those patrons, we hear from them right now. Dave Bastiansen, Chris Webster, Javier Wasiak, Graham Ward, James Walton, Joe Tyler, Therese, Krishna Simone Say, Andy Shockney, Ross Sandberg, Chance Russo at Drago Russo, Vladimir Prenner from Croatia, Robert Pasley, Post Fiction RPG Audio, Mighty Zeus, Mike Olson, Tom Nelson, creator of the player or the deck of player safety, not the player of deck safety. That's a whole other thing. Falcon Neal, Sean Molly, John Mickey, Eric Mengi, the Mathemagician, Magician, Chad Lench, Jim Klingler, aka DM Prime Mover, Brian King, Chad Jackson, Sean Hurst, Ben Heisler, and Paige Lightman, the Mighty Jerd. Thank you for the Black Ballad. Oh, Nathan Fuller, Andy Edmonds at nerdronomicon.com, Evil John, Merrick Blackman, Steve Bissonette, Craig Bailey, Lou Anders of Lazy Wolf Studios, and Keith Ammon of The Monsters Know What They're Doing. Thank you so much. You can support the show by going to patreon.com/masteringdnd. You can also help us by leaving us a review on Apple Podcast or subscribe and like via YouTube. We're at YouTube. .com/@masteringdungeons. So Teos, where can people find you?
Ooh, find me at alphastream.org. And I just started a kind of blog series paralleling what we're talking about. So the first one is talking about my first step I do for campaigns, where I actually, when I'm running the old one, I start a list of what I want next. So I intend to kind of just add little bits of my own kind of personal thoughts on campaigns, because I often have so many thoughts that we can't put them all in a show. So thought I would start a blog series on that. So find
There
it
you
at
go.
alphastream.org. Sean, where do we find you?
You can find me not writing things like that everywhere on social media at Sean Merwin, and you can follow the podcast on social media at MasteringDND. You can also, of course, go to that YouTube channel, Mastering Dungeons. So we have figured out how we are going to keep people coming back to our campaign. What are we going to do now?
I mean, if we chain them in our basement, they can't leave, and we just play all the time.
Then it really is Dungeons and Dragons.